music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Music among other things.
Love of my life. You've heard me.
You listen to that a lot lately. Is it you've hurt me?
I don't know, it's heard or hurt, isn't it?
I thought it was hurt. Yeah. So I was saying yesterday, I was like, oh, Soph, maybe this should be like a really nice first dance song. Like a really nice, like, broken down, like, acoustic or ukulele version. Yeah. I played it and I was like, I wonder if the lyrics, because it's such a romantic song, but I wonder if the lyrics are like positive or negative. And then like I played, I've been singing it all day, and I played it, I was like, love of my life, you've hurt me. Oh yeah, literally just like that. First lyrics, yeah. Like, fuck's sake.
It's weird that when you look for his lyrics, it's like you know Lou Reed's Perfect Day, do you know that song? Like, that's actually about heroin and not,
I think he said this to me before,
yeah, actually. So it's like, it's got quite a sweet sentiment, obviously, but you know, he's talking about the H man, and
it's a lot like that, isn't it? Like every breath you take,
Stalker.
That's actually a creepy ass song. Yeah. Beautiful song.
Bloody old Stalker sting, mate. Anyway, I'm Sean,
and I'm Neil.
He sounded really surprised there. Welcome to Music Among Other Things, or MAT for short, where we chat to musicians and creators about music and the worlds that orbit it. And today we're joined by a special guest, Matt Maltese, who came up on the London scene a few years ago as a singer-songwriter. He's put out two really amazing records in the past few years, and he's now bringing out his third record, Good Morning, It's Now Tomorrow, in October. Yeah, we had, well, actually, this was one of the first ones where we've had quite a few technical difficulties, wasn't it, Neil?
Yeah, unfortunately, with the Coic yeah. Wi-Fi let us down.
But I think the edit, I've patched it up nicely, I reckon. Yeah, I reckon it'd be quite hard. I reckon it'd be quite hard to tell when it all went wrong, but basically my Zoom crashed halfway through, there's a whole palaver. Matt was in the back of an Uber, which is actually quite an interesting environment to hear. So as we're talking, you might hear police sirens and things of that nature in the background.
It actually got me very jealous, and maybe miss London again, really, just hearing those background sounds.
Yeah,
kids screaming, like buses driving past. Yeah, I kind of miss that.
There's something quite nice about being in the back of an Uber half boozed, you know, just going through the night at like 2 a.m.
just like pleasant chaos, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like you're sort of safe and secure. It's usually like Magic FM or something playing, which is quite nice. But yeah, no, it's really great talking about. I've been a fan of him from the time he brought out his debut record, really. And yeah, we get into lots of things with him. We get into the new album. We get into a bit of his Canadian heritage, talk a bit about music videos. And also the fact that he's had this massive viral TikTok hit, which was really interesting, with As the World Caves In. So lots of people have been using his song to soundtracks and TikTok videos, which you'll hear more about.
Maybe as a gesture, we owe it to Matt to release our own MAOT TikTok video behind that track.
Maybe we should. It's quite a daunting platform, isn't
it? I think you've definitely got the voice to pull that chorus off. But he's got this lovely deep kind of Morrissey-like tone that you represent very well. We'll see.
Sort of crooner vibe, yeah.
We'll jam.
Yeah, I was thinking, actually, I mean, because we had a technical difficulty, I reckon people won't be able to tell exactly where my Zoom crashed and it all went wrong. So I reckon we should... If people can get the minute and second...
Or closest to.
Closest to, we'll... maybe we'll pre-order the new Matt Maltese album or something for him. Maybe we'll do that as a little prize giveaway.
Definitely. And we're not included.
Yeah, we'll look into that. We'll put something on social, so keep an eye out on there for MAT Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah, maybe we should get into it. keep an eye out for that technical hitch and when the Zoom crashes.
It's on my doing this on my phone.
Oh, that's all right. No worries. No worries.
So a little bit shaky, and I'm going to be getting in an Uber, so you're going to hear me say thank you for no reason.
Okay, cool. Awesome, man. Whereabouts are you? You're in a studio or something?
I think
you
might. Yeah, I just finished at my studio in like Hammersmith area, and going back to South.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. How about you guys? Where are you based?
I'm South London, sort of near Sutton, if you know that area.
Ish.
Yeah, there's nothing much going on here, mate. I wouldn't ever venture over here. But yeah, then Neil's up. Where are you again, Neil? Leighton Buzzard, isn't it?
Cheers, mate. Yeah, Bedfordshire. Bedfordshire way, so literally in the sticks. Again, not much around me either, so. It's our first ever Uber podcast, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, mine too. Hold awesome. On, just give me a second. I'm just trying to put some headphones in.
No worries, go for it. What's your Uber rating, Neil?
Good question. I was literally like having a little tidy up my apps yesterday. I was hovering over Uber about to delete it, and I was like, it's going to come in handy one day.
are you there, Matt?
Yes, I'm here. I just caught the end of your Uber. Have a good chat.
4.64 stars.
I'm on 4.67.
Ooh. Mine is 4.82. Wow.
Bloody hell. What are you doing?
Left you in the dust. It's all the thank yous. It's all the thank yous.
Yeah, just the politeness.
As I get in and out, it's almost like reflexive now.
That's excellent to hear. Well, looking forward to hearing the background noise of an Uber. It's going to be fun to listen to, I think. but thanks so much for your time, man. Really appreciate you coming.
Oh, no worries. No, thank you for having me.
What are you doing? Are you rehearsing at the minute?
A little bit, yeah. I'm sort of doing rehearsals and also just like writing for other people these days.
Great.
Which has been really great.
Like, awesome.
That's right, yeah, Matthew. There you go, it's my Uber chat. So like sort of started it in lockdown, just because obviously live shut down and I just had all this time on my hands, and
yeah,
kind of just wanted to be writing every day. Just realized how much I needed that as well, you know, just to have that is kind of my main sense of purpose, I think, comes from that. And it sort of got to a point where I'd written my album, or my next album, and just was like, oh, I don't want to keep singing about me. And yeah. what about sort of writing for other people? And then I just had some really good experiences of it. And it's become a big part of my life now. Yeah, I really love it. It's I also feel like, most people probably say this, but like I never really was drawn to like the spotlight very much, you know. So suddenly, when you're doing a job where you're not the boss of that,
yeah,
room, it was a totally new dynamic, which I loved.
Yeah.
And like working with people where you're kind of working for them, I really liked that. Like, you don't really get that, I guess, when you're just like doing your own artist thing. You're like sort of the boss of every music room in a way. Not to say that you like act like a prick, but you do sort of call the shots because it's your thing at the end of the day, but when you're then suddenly on someone else's turf, it's like I really enjoyed that.
It's quite nice like facilitating that, really, because I get that with cooking to a certain extent. I really love clear instructions for some reason. I get like real satisfaction out of it, but
yes.
I probably follow the rules too closely.
Did not just compare making an album to cooking.
Basically the same
thing. He did, and I love it. I love it. I love the analogy. Yeah.
But is there anything, anybody you can tell us that you're, I mean, who you're writing for? Is there anything you can tell us about that?
I've written for some artists who are sort of pretty early on in their careers, but also a couple like songs coming out soon. I like this one song I wrote with Joy Crooks for her first album.
Nice.
Which is, just a lot of ballads, really.
Yeah. And you seem like the go-to man for a ballad as well, so she's in good company.
I do live for them. So I think if there was anything I was going to be eponymous with, then it would be ballads. Definitely.
I heard you were shooting a video last week. I think that's what your management was talking about. But I saw obviously like the first couple of videos in this cycle. First time you're on the back of a motorbike for sure. You're buried in sand, and obviously for both of those, you didn't really have too much to do in the actual video. And I wonder if you engineered that on purpose so there's like minimal effort involved in your part. Would that be accurate to say, or was it just like luck of the draw on that one?
I think a little bit luck of the draw, but I got to say it felt like a lot of effort both times.
Oh, did it
really? I mean, I think videos, especially when you're not working with like big money budgets, it's sort of up to you to make the most out of the budget you have a lot of the time. And like producers are amazing and directors are amazing, but I also feel like there's a duty as the sort of person who the video is for to be like working incredibly hard, because a lot of people aren't really being paid that well on those shoots when you have a small budget.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, the sand one, it really does look like I'm just sitting there, which I am, but that was probably the most uncomfortable I've ever been, because I just underestimated how heavy wet sand is.
Right, yeah.
And I was just like under this wet sand. Taking a breath was pretty painful. But yeah, the next one I've gone on like basically it's like in an amusement park, and it's got like I'm going on like rides essentially. And so again, you're probably gonna accuse me of just sitting back and letting the rides happen. I did this like G-force ride where it spins and the gravity sucks you in.
Yeah.
And you sort of then spin at 90 degrees. And I can say that it was much worse in the sand. It was like, I did the ride about 6 times, and my organs were not born to be pushed in with gravity that much.
Are you miming as you're doing that as well?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, I find music videos, I really sort of love them, as much as they sort of kill me every time. There's something about the format which is still really, I mean, it's all kind of for the day, really. The 3 weeks before and the week after of recovering are always pretty not the one, but the day itself is, I find them really fun, yeah.
It's weird, actually. My sister was actually in one of your videos. It was for Less and Less. It was like the speed dating one. Yeah. I think she only knew it for a split second. But
that's amazing.
Yeah, sort of.
Say hi from me.
I will do, yeah. She always bloody talks about it, so I'll make sure I pass it on. I was quite interested, actually. I spotted the Tragically Hip t-shirt you were sporting in Mystery. And before, when I was doing some research for the pods, I had no idea that you were part Canadian. I know people often refer to that band particularly as like evoking like the spirit of Canada, or they're like intrinsically Canadian.
Yes, people hold them really dear.
I was wondering what your connection is with that band, because they're a band that I know ahead by a century, but I really need to do some digging into their back catalogue.
So With that t-shirt, I was in Canada when I bought it, obviously. It was like in this Toronto like secondhand store or whatever. And
yeah.
I'm wearing it in front of my cousin, Vanessa, and she's like, "Oh, the Tragically Hip." And I'm like, "What?" And I'm like wearing the t-shirt, not even knowing it was a band t-shirt.
Oh, right. Nice.
And it was, I was like, I can't believe I'm one of those people that's like, you know, wearing a Kurt Cobain t-shirt thinking he's a brand. Not that they ever do that, but like I didn't actually know of them before I bought the t-shirt.
And then
sort of Vanessa showed me all these, my cousin showed me all these like videos and explained the sort of place they had in Canadian music culture. And
Yeah.
It's quite a strange band to have that place, I thought. It kind of reminded me of the sort of like, I don't know, the sort of dad rock thing that like Australia have going on as well. You know, it's like these bands you wouldn't think would be like the big, like, I can understand if Canada make like Michael Bublé their guy. But yeah, didn't really. I thought the music was pretty nice, but I really can't claim to be an expert. I'm just one of those idiots wearing the t-shirt, basically.
Yeah, from listening to them, I'm surprised they've got a lot of like merch about. But
yeah, exactly. I mean,
perhaps that's exactly what it is. Really, it is tragically hip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said it, not me. Yeah.
Do you get over to Canada much yourself then?
Yeah, I used to go pretty much every Christmas.
Oh, nice.
Just because that's where sort of all my family live, and my parents. When my sort of grandparents, well, I only have one grandparent who's alive now, but when they were all alive as well, it was obviously quite important for my parents to try and go back as much as possible. So, visited it a lot as a kid. Yeah, I love it. I find it sort of a second home, definitely.
I went to Banff in Canada. I have a weird memory because it was like the first time I heard My Chemical Romance's Black Parade, which was a big impact in my teenage life, was when I was like going down a water slide in the hotel we were staying in. And I actually had the same thing happen with the first time I heard The Scientist by Coldplay, which we were discussing last week. It's weird, like, always on water slides for some reason I'm hearing these songs for the first time.
So you were on a water slide wearing what kind of headphones?
Oh, I wasn't wearing headphones. It was just on, like, you know, like, the system. It's just playing out. I mean,
that makes a lot more sense. I thought you were the most psycho kid of all time.
Yeah, just got in on the waterproof headphones game really early.
In the headphones, I love that.
Is it your mum's Canadian? She's an opera singer, is that right?
Yeah, so my parents are both Canadian, and my mum, she was an opera singer, and she's like a singing teacher now.
Amazing! Oh wow.
Yeah, so I had a very loud mum, basically, and I still have a very loud mum. Yeah.
Does she ever give you any like singing tips or anything like that?
Yeah, as a kid, I sort of had a few like lessons with her. She's like a good, healthy, critical person of me with singing, which I think is good. You know, when she says something good, she means it, and when she has a thought of how it could be better, she won't hold it back.
You got to hang on to those people in your life.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's kind of the mixture of like a biased parent and like a savage singing teacher. All in one.
Very good resource to have at an early age.
It is.
So it's weird. Speaking of like, you know, influential Canadians on your life, because I thought tragically Hit was going to be one of them, but obviously not. But when I first came across your stuff, I was particularly drawn to the fact that you had that. You covered Paper Thin Hotel by Leonard Cohen from Death of a Ladies Man, which is a song, you know, I've loved for age. And I was like, oh, this guy's like 19 and he's...
Yeah, shot you cut out for a bit.
Am I back on?
You're fine.
You're back on.
So
yeah.
My connection's unstable. All right, we keep going. If anything happens again, just let me know.
I think it just sensed a very poor story about to come from your mouth.
It's the kind of editing process for me.
It's Zoom's new feature, yeah.
You're talking shit, mate. I'm going to shut you down.
Yeah.
But I was thinking if this guy's 19 and digging Leonard Cohen and things like that, it's a sort of a good sign. And I was wondering if that was like an era of Leonard Cohen you're particularly drawn to, because I think to proper fans of his, it's like a weird period and sort of aged a bit better than it had done,
that was my favorite Leonard Cohen album, and one that I just sort of, because I fell in love with Leonard Cohen that wasn't that, you know. I fell in love with Suzanne and So Long Marianne and Famous Blue Raincoat and all those, you know, very reflective, more intimate moments, and then this record sort of comes out of nowhere in his catalogue as this sort of quite sort of brash, unhinged album. And I think I think it was yeah, it was kind of perfect as well, because I sort of think at that age when I was falling in love with them, sort of like 18 or whatever, 90, you kind of, you want to be this like rebellious thing more than you want to be the guy listening to like really slow, sad music. And yeah. So it was like, I had my sort of love of Leonard Cohen combined with like, oh, I can like this punky album.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just found it, yeah, just such a beautiful mix, really, of like, God forbid me say his name, but Phil Spector's like really yeah. insane production.
Yeah.
And sort of an album full of just incredible phrases and songs. Yeah. And it, yeah, I sort of liked that he hated it, you know. It was like,
yeah,
such a good album to listen to when you're like, oh, this is so strange that it's everyone's, you know, all the punk's favorite Leonard Cohen album that Leonard Cohen hated, but that's full of like a lot of magical moments. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. I think, I guess people probably had like, or proper like Cohen heads back in the day probably didn't like the Spectre production and stuff, but obviously, like,
I think so, yeah.
Like you say, like Spectre's quite a weird figure. I think I heard some stories about those sessions where he like pulled a gun on a fiddle player because he wasn't getting the line right or something.
Jesus.
Yeah. And I heard like a story where he's had his arm around Leonard Cohen, sort of with a pistol in his hand, like saying, "I love you, Len." And Leonard's like, "I hope so."
It's not really a great vibe, that, is it? To sort of
no, I mean, bizarre, just unfathomable, really.
But, yeah.
But yeah, I think, yeah, that is just one of my all-time favorite albums. I still go back to those songs now and again.
Yeah, I'm really interested in your songwriting. As you know, I feel like there's been a real shift, particularly on this record as well, because I think I heard a lot of like Leonard Cohen on that first record, and I think I noticed on this album it feels like the tongue's being pulled more from your cheek, if that makes sense. So there's some really like beautiful intimate moments on the record, but there's also a lot of the humor still remains, which is really cool. But obviously, yeah, I know you sort of develop your own style as you go along, and you know, you absorb your influences a bit earlier on, but I'm always intrigued as to, when I'm talking to lyrics people, what sort of pricks their ears up. And I was wondering, yeah, who were you sort of listening to, or who were you who was exciting you in terms of lyrics, like when you were coming into this project?
I'd say that lyrically, I think strangely been drawn to sort of slightly sweeter sounding songs than I used to. I think I almost, at 18, 19, I think I was just one of the most cynical people that existed. And I think it sort of, yeah, it came with the territory of being someone who was quite clearly like drawn to romantic songs and romantic feelings, and but didn't want to be another one of those guys. And I think I sort of matched that by being incredibly sort of like self-knowing and cynical about it all. And then I feel like as the years have gone by, I do feel like I've sort of shed that skin and been more open with feeling something sentimental and embracing that. And so I guess lyrically I'd say I was more listening to your sort of like your Bell and Sebastians like Bill Callahan, Vashti Bunyan, Karen Dalton. Yeah, sort of like very, almost like country lyrics.
Yeah.
were like sort of appealing to me more in the past few years than before. These kind of like quite sort of broad assertions of love and pain. I don't know. Yeah. I feel like these days I'd much rather listen to a sweet song than a Father John Misty song, and maybe back then it was the other way around. And that's not to really say one is worse than the other. I just want to be as hopeful as I can be, because I know that I have the constitution to not be, and I feel a responsibility as well to be hopeful. It's like I think comforting people is kind of the least I can do if I'm going to do anything with my music. And I think, yes, there's comfort in knowing other people are cynical too, but I also think there's a lot of comfort in being cynical, but in a sort of still being silly and sweet, and being okay with being silly and sweet and not thinking that it at all like makes your sentiment any less poignant. I actually think that being silly is like almost the most vulnerable thing you can do in a song, and there's just not enough of it. It's everyone takes things too seriously, I think.
Yeah, I think like that country songwriting is really, I feel like it's almost cut through in recent years. You know, you've got like the rise of people like Casey Musgraves and people like that.
Yeah.
Because there's country songwriting is by no means like easy to do, but you know, it's not simplistic, but you get a real image as soon as you listen to it, or you know exactly what the lyrics are trying to say. And I think that's almost become more apparent in recent years because it's just been so messy everywhere. Do you know what I mean? I think that's why it's cut through.
Yeah, that like idyllic pastoral thing and the space and sort of not trying to be clever. I think there's a real, you realize that sort of not trying to be clever is kind of the cleverest thing you can do. And I think, I think when I was growing up, I sort of felt the other way a bit and thought that everyone who was being sweet wasn't also very knowing. And actually that's not the case. I think a lot of people are sort of sweet and joyful despite a very strong sense of the doom. And that's almost like the most powerful type of person, I think.
And I mean, the title of the record, I mean, record as well, but you know, me and Neil have had it for the past couple of days, you know, proper love in the record, you know, congratulations on it.
Oh, thank you.
Really enjoying it. But obviously, like, Good Morning, It's Now Tomorrow is a sort of telling title, feels like the past year, do you know what I mean? Time's moving and it's really strange.
Yeah.
It's like day after the next, day after the next. So I take it a lot of this was, like you said, written in lockdown,
Yeah, and it was that kind of like, keep calm and carry on energy that I feel like was pervading everywhere.
Yeah.
Despite this like insane amount of chaos, which kind of inspired this. And I feel like the record was written under those circumstances of like, okay, I'm just going to write this album despite the fact that everything is completely batshit. And I think that sort of, I mean, I feel like the title track touches upon that a bit, and it's sort of, you know, even when they were like literally burning witches at the stake, they still sort of said good morning every day. And I think like it's just such a bizarre thing we do as humans, isn't it? It's just the carrying on element, the fact that no matter what, we still spiral towards the next day. And
what's your kind of like setup in lockdown and stuff?
So I kind of wrote. I would sort of, it was in the same room that I wrote my second record, and it was, I don't live in that house anymore, but it's a small room in sort of like a flat of six people. I would sort of just, I'd get up every morning and, which is how everyone starts their day. I should never say that. And I would like exercise or whatever, go for a run around this small park near me, just sort of six or seven times like a hamster, and then just write. And I sort of did that for a good 3 or 4 months. And I found, I mean, most of my sort of brightness in my life was coming from just having that, you know. I felt incredibly lucky as well that I had that environment already, you know, and that actually, because I was quite used to it, or sort of writing in my room, it's almost like those days when I was writing in my room, I could forget about everything, you know. I could forget that it was different outside than it was the year before. I'd still be very like acutely aware of it, but I think I always just find that like I've lost that sense that it's about waiting for your muse or your inspiration. And actually, the more hours I put in, the more songs I get, and it's not to say at all that they're less inspired or anything. But that was kind of my attitude to this record, like the sort of one before it was as well. And I think I sort of just got to a place I really liked by the end of the summer and was like, oh, this feels like a body of work. Sort of the coping mechanism became like the record, you know? And yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if you worked that way, whether it was because you hear from some songwriters where it's like, it's almost like they just get a call in and they've got to write, you know, this specific thing.
Yeah, I hate that.
And then you're very much of the thing where you're like every day just writing and
I just think it's a job. I think to not treat it as a job is, it's almost quite disrespectful to the music. I just think this idea that we exist on a plane where like we're too good to like have to sit down every day at 10 a.m. and like work is ridiculous. I just think I really can't get on board with that. And I get that some people work better in the evenings or work better, whatever. But I think people who aren't consistently putting time and sort of work into their everyday when they're in music or in any art form are sort of, I mean, it just also just feels disrespectful of the people that like do a job that isn't that and hate it and still have to work every day. It's just like,
yeah.
You shouldn't. I think treating yourself any different is silly. And
we've spoken to quite a lot of people actually who have, you know, made music in the past year while they've been in lockdown. I was wondering what your what your relationship is with your neighbours or your like flatmates. Have you had any incidents where it's been like you gotta shut the hell up now?
Well, I was really lucky in my old house. Shout out to Leah Cooper, who was like the sort of flatmate next to me for 3 years and sort of heard the second album being made and the third. And I sort of had that awful realization 2 months into living with her that she could basically hear every single thing I was singing. But but she was just incredibly, incredibly accommodating and would joke about it and sing it back to me as a joke. And just, yeah, it was really nice. I think my whole life and work output could have been so different if I was living next to a tosser. I was very lucky, very lucky.
That's great to hear, man. I was really interested in the fact that obviously I know that first record you did, you sort of did with other producers. I think you went to LA and did that. And obviously I know Chris was much more of a homemade affair and as is this one. And I was wondering what the sort of like differences are in the process and which you prefer. Because I imagine it's probably quite nice having that guidance when you're doing your first record and then, you know, the rest of it is sort of like you call the shots, which must be quite nice.
It's hard to say which one I preferred. I think they both suited the sort of time. I think with the first record, I really enjoyed bringing people into the process after I'd done it on my own for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Sorry, just getting out of this car.
That's all right, mate.
Thank you.
Take your time, don't worry.
There's my thank you. There's my 4.8 star.
You've got to take a leaf out of your book, mate.
It'll go down because he's just been hearing all this shit we've been talking
about. Oh, yeah, poor guy. God bless the Uber drivers that have to hear pretentious musicians talk about their work.
There's another unfollow on MAOT.
I think, yeah, in the, sort of the first record, I sort of also really craved... I think I craved validation a bit more and really sort of comfort in working with, I found comfort in working with someone like Jonathan Rader, who just I like incredibly respected and had sort of grown up a bit listening to Foxygen and was just like, you know, I was just like a kid being like, oh, wow, that he even wants to like make my album with me. And I think that then gave me a lot of confidence to make the kind of record I did, which, so I think it was great for the time. And then I think by the time Crystal came about, so much had changed. I'd sort of been dropped by my label and was kind of in a bit of a space of like, well, I probably have one last shot at an album and I'll see what this does. And I also want to spend like a 25th of the money because I don't have any. And it was kind of perfect for what I needed. I think at that time I also needed to go back to what I was before and also sort of have the buck stop at me, you know, every decision
mm.
be made by me, and not feel any sense of like, oh, I'm making this decision influenced by this person because my label likes that person and they're paying that person and all those dynamics, which just as a 19-year-old was just a lot. And I felt with the second record it was kind of important to have a record that that felt quite vulnerable and didn't have someone overseeing it, sort of, who could say yes and make me feel like it was the right decision. You know, it was sort of up to me to make the final, not even just make the final call, but it was up to me to sort of validate myself a bit and sort of put my neck out a bit more, maybe just on the sort of sense of like the production front, I think, as well. And looking back, I think it was I really needed to make the kind of record that my sort of 17-year-old self would probably have made, which was a more sincere record where stuff was a bit scrappier and didn't have as much overthinking and back and forth with people. Yeah, didn't have as much many people in the process. I think you can quite quickly bring quite a lot of people into the process, especially on, I guess, on a label or something. And I think losing that was really good for that record and sort of set the tone for how I felt like I'd find my validation in better places these days, I think. And don't really crave it like I used to. I think because I made that second record the way I did and
it must give you a lot of confidence as well, to be fair. Just
I think it did, I think it was a sort of quite unconfident time, you know, like I said, I didn't really know if it would be like probably like the last one I was able to make because of where my sort of career was at or whatever. But I think sort of doing it and then realizing that no one really noticed that I was playing the bass myself in it. And it was like a bit crap, but it's just like still good, I guess. So it was just like, it was a good record to make for my self-esteem as well. Yeah.
I think also having that, I mean, getting the production chops down is a really hard thing to do as well. And I think if you've got both the songwriting and production stuff, then you can sort of, you know, conquer anything really. And I guess it's more the production side of things, like way more experience, because there's people I know who are producers and they just hear something on a different level to me. And it's not something you can really learn from a book. It's literally just through intense work and listening and just something like you craft over quite a while. Because I was interested in who you maybe collaborated with on this record, because I know you did some work with Vegan on the last record, and it's cool to hear you featured on Frank Ocean's Beats One, which is obviously real high praise there, which is awesome. But yeah, who else did you maybe collaborate on, or who's like a good ear for you apart from your mum, as you were talking about earlier?
I think with this record, Tom Carmichael, who sort of mixed some of Crystal, was a really natural choice, just because we already had a working relationship, and I think this time kind of demanded a sort of like family-esque feel to it a bit, and people that you're already comfortable with and had already worked with. And I think it's more that I sort of still collaborated in a way, sort of on the writing front. You know, one song was with Alex Bury, who's sort of been a part of one song of every record so far. And I think being able to have someone like Bedouin come in and sing on the record was a really like special thing for me as well. I sort of adore her music, and sort of involving someone in a sort of duet capacity was I guess something quite new for me. And I didn't feel as much like I was like collaborating with a producer. I still sort of took quite a lot of ownership of the arrangements and how I wanted things to sound. And I think I find it a little bit hard to let that go now I've got it as well, you know. It's like after Crystal, it's actually quite hard to imagine going back to a time where I could let someone just do that side of things. And and I think maybe there will be scope for that in the future, because I think that would probably be pretty healthy. But I think again with this record, it was just that sense of, if you sort of know you can do it yourself, it's like, why wouldn't you? Other than the fact that it's a lot more work.
It sounds like you've put yourself out of your comfort zone a lot more. Like, is this shit scary? It must have been a lot scary.
Yeah.
Album, but now after it, like we all have in life experiences, you're so glad for it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you sort of always have this, I think for the kind of music I make as well, you maybe have this idea that if it wasn't the kind of music I make, maybe I'd have this idea more that like a producer's going to, you know, turn my music into something, completely different. But I think I just feel like at the end of the day, I'm sort of here for the songs. And even when I'm listening to songs that have slightly unpredictable production, I find it endearing as long as the song's good. And
yeah,
I sort of realized, I think that, yeah, I kind of think whatever production is being used in my songs is kind of right, just because it's about the song. I don't know. I think that's probably something that producers would crucify me for. But
I mean, besides writing and making this album in, you know, the lockdown and everything, what other like pastimes were you drawn to besides writing and everything?
I gotta say, it was pretty much 7 days a week. Like my sort of, yeah, because I'd sort of make my album on my weekends and spend the weekdays writing for other people. And yeah, I really sort of lent on it and on work, and just sort of doubled my workload really, and just enjoyed that, and enjoyed how escapist that was as well. And yeah, I wasn't sort of growing my sourdoughs.
yeah, I thought the Reddit line was gonna in one of the songs on the record was telling of just hours wasted on subreddits and stuff.
Oh yeah,
seems not.
Yeah. Oh, I can't deny there's always hours wasted on subreddits, but but it's not a new pastime by any means.
Yeah. What's your favorite sub?
Ooh. Anything love related is good. Yeah.
Yeah? I'll shut that one out.
Yeah.
Because it was weird. I mean, for me and my girlfriend, our record collection has grown substantially. We're just buying records every week. And obviously, we're doing this podcast as well throughout the time. But I think we bought like over like 50 records in a 6-month period, which is pretty bad, probably. But
amazing.
I read that before you moved to London, you used to like buy and sell vinyl, and I was wondering whether there was any records that you made a particularly hot profit off of.
Ooh, that's a good question. I remember having Pulp records and knowing who Pulp were, and that was sort of how I discovered Pulp. But I sort of sold the record before I'm glad I sold the record before I like really got into Pulp. But yeah. God,
it's
were
an
like,
ongoing trend, you're not knowing these tragically here.
Yeah.
Well, that was a job lot of vinyl. I'm a little bit less guilty there. But still, yeah. I mean, ridiculous. I didn't know who they were. But yeah, those were like 80 quid an album, which was good going. I sort of, it was a really good, it was a good little racket I had going on.
What Pulp album was that?
That would have been A Different Class, I think. That was was the one I remember that went for a lot of money. And because I think A Different Class had like 12 sort of cover variations.
So I think
if you had a certain one as well, I think if I remember that correctly, it was worth more money.
One that I've been trying to track down actually is Given to the Wild by the Maccabees. Like, you just can't get that anywhere. And I was sort of like, bring this neatly onto like you working with Hugo from the Maccabees. And I know you did that song with him as the world caves in, which must have been like quite a nice sort of lecturing like production or something. Like you've been able to take experience to work with him and Jonathan Rado and now to do your own thing, which is really great. And I was curious about this like TikTok craze, because it's great that, you know, the song As the World Caves In, obviously I was listening to your album, you know, when it first came out, so it's just so weird with TikTok that these songs that are like 3 or 4 years old can just become like massive.
incredibly strange.
But I'm always like intrigued about, you know, the stories, because they're usually quite random as to how they got there. But I mean, tell us a bit about what you know about your song and how that all kicked off with
I mean song. I don't really know the first video that did its thing. I think it was early on, it was a lot of sort of anime like content was sort of, right, they were connecting the song with this with the character arc of two characters from that show Devilman Crybaby.
Right, okay.
And they were sort of imagining that it was like their sort of torch song. And then I don't know, it just sort of that continued on its way, and then it got into sort of Harry Potter fandom. There was a lot of like Draco Malfoy combinations. Love and it. Then it was also had its like emo kind of crying videos where people would like be really chill and then just like scream out and cry when the song hit the chorus, and yeah, like just some bizarre content, amazing content. And then obviously Sarah Cothran, who sort of covered it 3 months ago, and that was already after it had its first wave, I guess.
Oh, gotcha.
The use of a better term, and so the second wave came from Sarah, really, and just sort of suddenly became this like harmony challenge. Wow. Challenge in its own way, just for people to like do a cover of it and sing it. And it's kind of like that chorus has sort of flown away from me. It's just that I'll see I'll sort of see a lot of videos every day of just a lot of people singing that chorus and it being about their own interpretation of it rather than it being about my recording of it anymore.
It must be pretty surreal. You must be like,
you always bizarre. Forget
that you've written it. Be like, oh, that's really
absolutely, yeah. Just the rooms and the sort of the environments that song finds itself in is just, it's mental. It's fully mental.
It's a nice way it's been used as well, because for a lot of people, it's like somebody's made a dance move and the instruction is in the song, but it's like people are actually connecting with the melody and lyrics and doing their.
Oh, definitely. It's so nice. Yeah, it's so nice. And again, I think it's probably like one of my most, I think as melodramatic as it is, I do like to think that it's like a comforting song. You know, it's not like we don't all know that reality or like imagine that reality. And it's like to go to sort of say goodnight to life, but with love is kind of the least you can hope for, really. So I feel like, yeah, I don't know, I feel like I'm sort of happiest that one out of all of them, really, to be honest. Yeah.
And it's crazy what it's done for, you know, your original recording as well, because obviously I think you were in like the top 200 most popular songs in the world, and last month you were in the top 100 in the US, which is crazy. And you know, you're next to the likes of Dua Lipa and Fleetwood Mac and stuff, and yeah, it's just pretty pretty insane that it's,
it was yeah it's been totally insane that I remember getting like a text from my manager and like being like, oh, today in the US like more people listen to that song than like or, like what's that, they're just a really big Harry Styles song, I can't even remember the name, but anyway,
yeah
then Watermelon Sugar or something like that, but it was just a very bizarre moment for that song. And
yeah, it's really interesting. So, you know, on Spotify you get all these facts and stuff. When I view your about on Spotify, can you take a guess at the five top cities where people are listening to you from?
I hope
London's number three.
Nah,
that's number three.
London. Oh, that's good. And then I'm gonna say a lot of American cities. It's got to be like, yeah, it's got to be.
So you got LA leading, followed by Chicago, Dallas 4, and Houston. So
yeah,
making it down south as well.
Yeah, the country guys.
Yeah, I mean, long may it grow. And it's great that it's like, you know, there's a lot of ploys for major labels to like reverse engineer hits, which is why you had like Drake doing like his version of the Cha-Cha Slide last year with Tootsie Slide and things of that nature. But I don't know if you can ever marry that, you know, the sort of instructional song with really good songwriting. I mean, that would be quite a feature to pull off, but I don't know.
That is what I should do. That's a good idea.
It's nice little challenge.
Yeah,
for the next one,
you should work at a label.
I know, right? well, Matt, thank you so much for your time and and bearing with the technical difficulties. I feel like we've been on a real journey through the Ubers and the crashes on Zoom and stuff.
All good. It really wouldn't be a Zoom without it.
Exactly.
Nice one, guys. Cool. Thank you. Take care. I'll see you soon.
Cool. Yeah. Have a good one.
Okay. Bye, bye, bye.
Well, we got there in the end with the... even though that sounded like quite a nice casual conversation, there was quite a lot of stress.
Oh, it was involved. Absolutely chaotic.
No, thank you so much to Matt for making the time and having the chat. Really great to talk to him. And this new record, I mean, me and Neil Bin had the pleasure of listening to it quite early, and yeah, really, really enjoyed the record. So everybody's in for a treat, and I assume there's going to be a single drop in just before it comes out, just because he was mentioning that other music video he's shooting. But yeah, everybody's got to keep their eye out for that. Well, if you like that episode, please give us a 5 stars and give us a follow on MAT Pod on Instagram and Twitter, and we will put out some detail around the competition about trying to nail down where that Zoom crash happened. Neil, well, I will see you for the next one.
Yes, mate. Absolute pleasure.
Ciao, ciao.